Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there, anywhere in the world. You can also download the podcast and listen later at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio as usual. Later in this hour, we'll be speaking to our PG and also our guest speaker for this week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, it's Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. Next Saturday, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, all being well, our guest speaker is Chris Dale. Lots to talk about today. Oh, first up, don't forget, next weekend, starting Friday 23rd until going on till Sunday the 25th of January 2026, it's the RSPB Big Garden Birdwatch 2026. Over 590,000 people took part in that birdwatch last year, counting a whopping 9.1 million birds. House sparrows took the top spot, but sadly numbers are down of those species by 60% compared to the first birdwatch in 1979. We've lost 38 million birds from UK skies in the last 60 years. It's really important you get involved then. Gives a valuable insight to how things are faring. So choose a one-hour period sometime on Friday the 23rd, Saturday the 24th or Sunday the 25th of January, so that's next weekend. Only record birds that land in your patch. And your patch can be a little bit of your garden, balcony, local park or green space. Record the highest number of each bird species you see at any one time. And even if you see nothing at all, it still counts. And you can submit your results online or by post. So just Google Big Garden Birdwatch. All good stuff, eh?
Right. Sheffield Photographic Society Open Photograph Competition 2026. The deadline is 21st of February 2026. So you have to email This is the email address, spsphotography514@gmail.com. That's spsphotography514@gmail.com for more information. But we'll talk to Gareth later.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll tell us lots more. There's loads of pictures coming in for that competition. Yes. So if you follow them on Facebook and Instagram, you'll see those.
They have been busy, haven't they,
They have indeed. Also, a reminder, if you go on to www.smartphonefreechildhood.org, you can sign the Parent Pact online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Big hot topic at the minute. Next up, I saw this article in the press at the end of last year. Record numbers switching to low and no alcohol beers in 2025. So Britons were on track to consume more than 200 million pints of non-alcoholic and low alcohol beer back in 2025, a milestone that confirms a dramatic shift in our nation's drinking habits. Nearly 170 million new and low beers were drunk in 2024, and that figure is to grow by almost a fifth to 200 million, according to research from the British Beer and Pub Association, or BBPA, who predicted that 22 million no alcohol and low alcohol pints will be poured in December alone. The no and low alcohol category has grown 750% since 2013 as brewers invest and pubs adapt their offerings. Recent figures from the charity Drink Aware found that 45% of people had consumed no and low alcoholic drinks in the past year, double the 22% recorded in 2021. So Luke Bowes is a founder of Lucky Saints, which is a zero alcohol beer now on draft in 1,000 pubs, said the company had made record sales. He says, we're seeing this across every month of the year. It's becoming ingrained as part of how people are drinking. Now, Emma McLaren, who's chief executive of the British Beer and Pub Association, or BBPA, said the boom demonstrated how effectively the industry responds to emerging trends. She said, the pub has always been about more than getting a drink, and it's inspiring to see so many people choosing to moderate while celebrating, whether it's a festive season or some other event. Drinks companies are grappling with consumers reining in their spending, and a more health-focused younger generation generally is drinking less booze. So non-alcoholic beers accounted for 2% of total global beer volume last year, according to IWSR, which is an analytics company, and they're forecasting that that level globally will reach 3% by 2027. So I thought it was really interesting. That was reported at the end of last year. That's another trend that's continuing. So elsewhere in the science news this week, before we talk to RPG, the National Trust, this is a really interesting one. The National Trust has received its biggest ever cash donation of £10 million from a philanthropist who received a CBE in the New Year's Honours List for services to tackling homelessness and for education. Not only that, but Humphrey Batcock's donation is unrestricted, giving the charity the freedom to spend it as it sees fit. Last year, the charity launched its 10-year strategy, pledging to make its biggest contribution to addressing the catastrophic decline in nature in its history. Wow. So really interesting.
Right. Another interesting story. Meanwhile, Britain faces running out of timber because the country has stopped planting enough of the trees required for house building. The UK ships in 80% of the wood we use each year, making us the world's second largest net importer of timber behind China. This is a matter of national security, said Tony Juniper, the chair of Natural England. Wood is a critical resource.
Yeah, so two interesting stories there. And finally, researchers from the University of Newcastle have pioneered a process to recover almost all of the silver inside end-of-life solar panels, marking a step forward for the renewable circular economy. The team, led by Associate Professor Mashid Firouze, said they will also investigate the recovery of silicon in future projects. Great stuff.
The heavens when you're sleeping in your bed, someone turns a light on. Can you feel it burn inside your head? to be reborn or has to die. Children of past summers, we are moving to the end. Can you wave your hand? And have you heard the plan? It's time to chew the man. Play on, play on. Jack's silver and the dolls, a Venus span the space between us with a tune. Jack's silver and the dolls, a Venus play their music specially for you.
Very interesting track there. Jet Silver and the Dolls of Venus, no less, by Bebop Deluxe, the great Bill Nelson. You know, we're big fans. And we played that because the University of Newcastle are doing some great research process to recover silver from the end of solar life, end of life solar panels. Sorry, I've been so distracted by that track. You are listening, of course, to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, the usual bits and pieces and a few things that have turned up. But some research by the University of Leeds, which is a new area that caught my eye. And they've done some research into microplastics. And they found out that on a local analysis, the amount of microplastics that are being found in urban areas is more concentrated in areas with woodland and greenery than in the town areas, which is a bit kind of not what you'd expect, I guess.
Yeah.
And the hypothesis that they've got for that is that the trees are actually pulling microplastics out of the environment, and therefore they're becoming concentrated in those areas where the sort of foliage and the greenery is managing to pull it out of the air. But obviously then it remains in those areas. So how perfidious the microplastics are becoming it seems to reach new heights every time I read something. So I don't know what we can do, but obviously now we've said about, I think we're all carrying microplastics in our bloodstream, in our bodies in various amounts, and there's one sort of viewpoint that says you shouldn't worry about it, and another one that says, well, it's happening. So we don't know how it will sort of continue. And I guess that kind of trips into one of the other things that I saw, which is that the genome of the woolly rhinoceros, which disappeared from Earth in the Ice Age, has been mapped recently in a strange way. They actually unearthed the remains of a wolf, that had at some time 140 million years ago eaten a woolly rhinoceros, and then managed to extract the complete DNA information of the woolly rhinoceros from the remains inside of a dead wolf.
Wow, that's some undertaking, isn't it?
That's the kind of one that, I sort of scratched my head and thought, wow. But, what they're saying is that gives them some insights now that they didn't have onto how they survived and why they're no longer around. And they're saying that it doesn't look like it's a catastrophic event. It looks more like a depopulation. For some reason, the population withered away very quickly. That's kind of another interesting bit of science research. But I guess the other thing that caught my eye was, two things that are interlinked, I guess. One is the process, we have mentioned it before, about geomagnetic reversal. That's the reversal of the direction of Earth's magnetic field. So the magnetic fields generated by the movement of the iron core, the molten iron core of planet Earth, and that will generate the magnetic field, and it's the thing that a lot of people hanker after seeing, that produces things like the Northern Lights. So that's the magnetic field, but it's actually moving, and there are things like the South Atlantic anomaly where the magnetic field is weaker for some reason, and that seems to have gone through a cycle where it sort of moved out of Africa, off the African coast, across the water to virtually into Brazil. So that anomaly is sort of moving around, and that means we're shifting the sort of magnetic poles, because every so often in Earth's history, they will flip in sort of probably not a human lifespan kind of time. It's certainly ages for shifts, but there is a continual shift happening, and it's kind of an underpinning that says that the Earth's crust, we talk about being on solid ground, but in actual fact, the ground beneath our feet is continually on the move. It may not be at the surface level where we are, but beneath that, there is movement. And that sort of took me on to another sort of idea, which some research has been done in Greenland. And we've found scientifically it's difficult to understand what's beneath the ice caps. So they can be very deep, tens of kilometres deep to even beyond that. And they've not really been able to see below that. In fact, they say for science that we probably know more about distant planets, ice and what's beneath it, than we do about that on our own planet. So again, I think forever man looking out into the skies and looking beyond Earth sometimes misses what's happening on Earth. We've sort of seen that in the deepest oceans, that it's still as rare an environment as outer space. And the ice caps, they were finding great difficulty, even though satellites were scanning. What they found is that the best scans were on the passes and would leave channels between sort of areas about 7 kilometres apart. So it was kind of a grid of the ice caps. And what the scientists have done is to look again at the data that's been collected over time and analyse that data. Because what they said is that there are going to be some kind of movement, and the current mapping doesn't allow us to do that. But by aggregating this over time, they can start to see areas of movement. And they say it's a little bit like water, that what's happening on the surface is probably driven by things that are happening underneath. And surprisingly, underneath the frozen land of Greenland, they found an underground river that's, well, a below the ice cap river that's flowing with water, where you'd expect it to be frozen.
No.
And they can actually identify the levels of the lands because, as we're talking about the geomagnetic movement, there's geographical movement, there's the drift of the continents and movements which will be evidenced on the surface by aggregating this data. So maybe that's what's attracting some people on Earth to fancy taking over Greenland.
Well, I think the more interesting what might be in the ground now, it's thawing out, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's interesting because, I mean, the other thing is, spoiler alert for any kids who are listening, where's the North Pole? And the truth is that the North Pole, although there are three variations of it, there's the true North Pole, magnetic North Pole, and the geomagnetic North Pole. And what's happening is that this movement is occurring over time, and it's shifting the pole, geomagnetic North Pole, which was centred in Canada, and it's progressively creeping across towards Siberia. So when you're sending off your letter to Santa, it's going to have which pole is the right address that you want to send it to. But again, it's this thing of movement, and that's the thing that really caught my attention, that science is always trying to map where we are and where possibly we're going in lots of different areas. And some of those things, I mean, we talked about it, I think they've had some tremendous results from the weather satellites that they put up in this last year or two, which are looking in detail at the Earth's surface to see changes, climatic changes. And again, that's part of maybe understanding the shifting ice cap can help us to gauge some of the climatic changes that are happening. So, as I say, we think that we're standing on solid ground, and you know, it's one of those things, ooh, I'm glad when my feet touch the ground, but in actual fact, we are moving, and we are spinning in space at a pretty brisk rate, although gravity is keeping us anchored on that firm crust that we're experiencing. So, kind of an interesting area that things that you think are solid aren't.
Well, this is, yeah.
Yeah, and things that, they surveyed the North Pole, and I think since then, 100 and something years ago, it's only been surveyed about eight times since then. So that was the Ross expedition did that. And again, the Antarctic on the underside of the planet, as we like to see, has only been surveyed about 8 times as well. So there are these massive areas on the top of the planet and the bottom of the planet that we increasingly find that we know not a lot about.
Well, I think we once went somewhere and it showed you a map of the world way back, and we were below the equator.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd shifted, tectonic plates had shifted and we got pushed upwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you sort of have a look at the way that the continents have shifted, I think that they're talking now about a lot of the North Sea areas that they're finding were above water and that we had a land bridge to Europe.
Dogger Bank, sort of, isn't it? Dogger Bank, I think. Dogger.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think it's that, but there's, I guess it's one of the problems for a human being. We've got our sort of 70 by repute years on the planet. I think the oldest man in Saudi Arabia just died at they say the age of 142.
Good grief.
It can be a little bit questionable because their record keeping wasn't that great, but certainly the sort of number of people who seem to be appearing who are passing the 100 mark now is it looks to be increasing really well. And I think it's probably a lot of the developments that we've had sort of in sustaining ourselves and not having to work as physically hard to achieve that, because that was a lot of the thing was we wore our sort of bodies out a lot quicker in past times because we did a lot more physical work to keep feeding ourselves and keeping warm and keeping alive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting, but I think if to say there are three North Poles and there are going to be some changes as well, that it's moving faster. Again, it seems to move faster for a while and then slows down and will pick up again. But the reason it's important is because in modern life, we use it to anchor ourselves on our position on the planet for things like GPS.
Yeah, well, it's for everything, isn't it? Sailing, flying,
yeah. So location. If that moves, you don't know where you are and you're back to the days of early sort of discovery. Sailing that direction till you bump into something.
Or fall off the edge of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think it's square. But yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Cracking stuff, yeah. Paul. You've picked an amazing track as well.
Yes, I thought because we saw beneath the surface, it'd be time to go underground.
And it is a belting track. Brilliant, Paul. We'll speak Monday on the Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3.
Great, I look forward to it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Might say that I should strive for more, but I'm so happy I can't see the same things happening here today. A show of strength with your boys' brigade. And I'm so happy and you're so kind. You want more money, of course I don't mind. To buy nuclear textbooks for atomic crimes. And the public gets what the public wants, but I want nothing society's got. So I'm going underground,
going underground.
What if the brass bands play up? Some pleasure out to hate me. I've enough already on my plate. People might need some tension to relax me. I'm too busy dodging between the flags. You see, here's what you get. You made your bed, you better lie in it. You choose your leader.
leaders have placed your trust. As their lies will shut down and their promises rust. The security machines with paper rockets and guns. And the public wants what the public gets. But I don't give what the society wants. I'm going underground, going underground. What if the frost bands play up feet start to pound? Going underground, going underground. So let the boys all sing, or let the boys all shout for tomorrow. Till my head explodes. I turn on the news and my body explodes. Spying sheep on my TV screen. But this boy shout, but this boy scream. Going underground. Going underground. I'm going underground. I'm going
That was RPG's pick, Going Underground by The Jam, because he was talking about what's underneath us, the molten core of the earth and how it affects us. All interesting stuff. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. We should have Gareth Morgan on the line. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
Good
morning.
Happy New Year, can you believe?
I know, shocking.
I said that to you off air and you're like, what? Is it really? Yeah, I think it was back in December we talked to you about Christmas gift ideas and all them sorts of things. But
that's right,
it is indeed how time flies. But for people who don't know, you're a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
That's right.
And you're very active as a club, aren't you, on social media and in your events and everything?
Yeah, we're keeping quite busy. We've got our big exhibition coming up soon, so we're doing all the judging for that in the next few weeks. And we've got an open competition on, which I think you've seen a bit about.
Yes, so that is on, and I think the deadline is at the 21st of February, she says, thinking about it. You've had quite a few entries because they do, some of them are getting put up on social media.
Yeah, we try to get as many as we can up on social media.
But there's some cracking stuff and a full range of topics as well, or subjects.
Yeah, we've had more variety this year, and it's as you say, the quality is really good, so it's quite good. And it's open to anyone. I mean, as long as you live or work in Sheffield, the photographs themselves can be anywhere.
Can
in
be
the world
anywhere.
Or any topic.
And do they have to be recent photos, or is it? Is
no,
it,
no,
you,
no. Anything. It can be anything. You know,
digging in your archives. And are you, as club members, allowed to enter, or is this a public?
No, it's for non-club members.
Because you'd all be submitting all your photos, wouldn't
Although,
you?
Aliases. I have to say, we ran it last year, and I think three or four of the entrants are now club members.
Oh, brilliant.
Because you get into the...
Well,
know,
of course.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, that is good, because I think you are, as a club, you're growing. I mean, post-COVID, I guess, as with a lot of clubs, you had to go online and this, and
yeah,
you just started
I mean,
to
we,
build it back up.
And we... I mean, we lost a few members and we, you know, literally and numbers, you kind of people got out of the habit and numbers were looking a bit worrying at one time. But we're getting back there now. It's not back to the peak it was when I was president, of course. But,
well, of course. Well, you know the answer there then, Gareth.
Yes.
Get back to be a president. Can you be a president? Can you be a president more than once?
I don't know. I think so. I'll get some stick from that next week now.
You will. So the big exhibition, is this the one at the cathedral?
Yeah. This is the competitive one. So
so when do you know the dates of the actual exhibition? Because you're going through the process, aren't you, of deciding as a club what gets put up there?
Yeah, it's April. So I think it's Early April.
Yeah, we'll watch out. We'll watch out for
that. I'll give you the exact details near the time.
Because it's always a good exhibition, that, and that's where you as club members, your entries are judged, are they, by somebody independent?
Yeah. So you get a professional judge.
And you did,
from somewhere
I think
else.
You did rather well last year, if I remember.
Well, did okay, but you never know, because sometimes judges don't like a particular approach or. Yeah, so it's always a bit hit or miss. But,
yeah, brilliant.
We shall see.
We shall see. So this week you're going to talk about making money from photography. I guess there's a lot of money to be made if you're in the right place.
Well, there can be. I mean, I have to say it's not as easy as it used to be. Mm. And certainly when people, I'll give you my trite advice, I give everybody at the club who asks me how to make money out of photography, there's only one guaranteed way, and that's to sell your camera.
that's a bit harsh.
Well, it's a joke, really.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, but, yeah, I get you. Yeah.
You know, these days, the opportunities for, you know, making money out of photography, because so many people have got a camera in their pocket.
Yeah.
It you know, you find that you're competing not against a small number of other things, but you know, thousands of people are taking pictures of the same things, so the value has dropped tremendously. Things like sport and news that you know, used to be a mainstay of photographers, it's much harder to make money out of that now. So you kind of have to get a bit creative and look around, really. I mean, there still are opportunities to make money as a photographer, but I think you have to think about starting off small. My advice would always be, you know, unless you go down the professional road and do it at university and go into it that way, you know, think about joining a camera club and then think about building up a portfolio of stuff and finding your niche and then using that as a way to get into photography. So one of the big things at the moment that people are doing, as you know, I do a lot of portrait photography, and, you know, you can make money out of selling your skills as a portrait photographer. But the area that people are making money out of is pet photography.
Oh, it's big business, isn't it?
It's incredible. And it seems to be something that, because you need to do it, you know, people don't want to travel miles to take their dogs or cats or rabbits or whatever to have their pictures taken. If you can set up a nice little home studio, because you don't need a lot of space to do, you know, pet photography, and you're a good, competent photographer, you can make money off that. So I know quite a few people now who started out in the club world, but are making, I wouldn't say they're making a living out of it, but as a sideline to other things, it's really taking off. So it's a really good way of looking at starting out in the, you know, and you can grow from that once you've got something going. And you don't need a lot to set up, a simple background, some, you know, some cheap video lights, and you're ready to go.
Wow. Isn't that a reflection of society post-COVID, maybe, that, you know, a lot of people bought pets, didn't they? Got very, very attached to them. You know, there's a lot of money spent, isn't there, on pets now? You know, you can buy them jackets and dress them up however you want.
You can, and that's one of the things. I mean, I know I've got two friends who are really into it, one in the club, and you know, they do things like birthday photographs, parties for dogs. And, you know, I've seen pictures of dogs with party hats on, which is perhaps not my cup of tea, but it's, you know, it's a great thing. It's starting to take off.
But it can't be easy to photograph dogs and cats, I wouldn't imagine, because...
You need a bit of patience and some techniques. I mean, what you need is, I think for dogs, is some peanut butter or something else that the dog likes, a bit of cheese, and... a clicker to catch their attention. You need a reasonably well-behaved pet. I mean, dogs are much easier than cats. I know from what I'm told, cats are virtually impossible to.
Brilliant! You have done some photos of dogs. I think you've had the most entries in competitions, haven't you?
Well, I've done working dog photographs in a barn, and. I mean, the great thing about them is they're trained, so they sit still. But getting them to look at the camera was the thing. So, you know, I literally was stood with the camera on a tripod and the clicker in one hand and my and a biscuit and my remote control in the other hand, trying to get them to look at me. So, because that's the thing, you have to have eye contact, you know, as with anything.
Well, it's interesting because I didn't know you were going to talk about this, but I saw an article in the press. It was in somebody had renovated the house in a particular way, massive house, big windows, big sofas, and there was this photograph. And they'd obviously placed the dogs where they want them. One was in a basket between two sofas. The other one was on a sofa. The one in the basket looked remotely happy. The one on the sofa looked seriously unhappy, as though, I don't know why I'm here. And it really drew my attention because it wasn't really about the dogs, but the dogs in effect stole the show, to be fair.
Yeah.
I thought, they ain't got that right with that photograph. Them dogs are not naturally happy.
It's true.
Yeah, so it's not as easy as it might be.
But that leads into something that I was also going to mention that is easier in a sense because it doesn't move, and that's like house photography, working for estate agents. Now that's something that a lot of people used to do, again in the club world, as a sideline because it's relatively straightforward. And estate agents used to need, you know, lots of photographs for advertising in papers and that. It's not quite as prolific these days because a lot of it's gone online.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is done with a mobile phone. You know, people do their own thing with Purple Bricks. But it's still an area to look at. But again, you need to build up a body of work to show that you can do that sort of thing. And that's another area to look at if you're interested in making a bit of money out of photography. And the other thing is looking at trying to support local businesses. So again, within the club, we've got a guy who's kind of worked out a niche for taking photographs of food. So he goes to not, you know, McDonald's and your big, you know, Pizza Express, not the big chains, but lots of local restaurants and pubs and clubs and that, and does like food photography for their websites, which is, well, it's not as easy as it sounds. You do need to have some tricks up your sleeve when you're photographing food to make it look nice. But actually, it's an interesting way into, you know, photography as a way of making a bit of money.
And it's big business. Websites, photography on websites is a big business anyway, isn't it? Whatever you're trying to sell. But I presume, you know, the payment for doing some photos for local businesses might be payment in kind, maybe a meal or food
I mean, I think most, even smaller businesses have a small budget for marketing. So, you know, as long as you keep your costs down, and you have to build up a portfolio of work. That's the thing that you've got to have something to show, you know.
To show that you've got the skill. And you know, to actually the idea of how you, because every photographer is going to have a different style, I guess.
Yeah, and to show that you've got the skill in that particular area, because it's not for everybody, and you know you've got to have the kit, for example, to get up close and show, you know, a plate of peas or whatever to be photographing, but make it look nice and stuff like that. But so there are opportunities, and that's kind of what I call active income generation, where you're actually doing something to earn the money. The other way, of course, is to sell your photographs.
Yeah.
Which, again, there's different ways of doing it. Through the club, when we do the exhibition, we do put notices up to allow people to, if they're interested, to buy the prints. And I think I've mentioned this before, you know, I've sold quite a few prints on the back of exhibitions. And that is, you know, it's quite a nice way of making a bit of money. There are a few people in Sheffield who have kind of turned it into a small industry. If you go to lots of the craft fairs and that around, you'll see the same few faces selling postcards and birthday cards and little prints, often of Sheffield scenes. It's quite a nice niche to get into. The problem is you have to outlay a bit up front before you get anything back.
But
which is the beauty of...
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, you know, the beauty of the exhibition route is you do one print, and then I think I've sold, of one particular print, I've sold about 10 now.
Really? Which one is it? Which one is it?
It's you'll probably know. It's of a Lancaster bomber. I took it a few years ago now, and I've even sold it to an ex-group captain in the RAF. Which I was quite surprised at.
Wow, so that's quite a niche market, though, isn't it? You know, you find your market, almost.
Well, you do, although, of course, at the exhibition, you get everything. So there's one of the ladies in our club who does montages of flowers. You may have seen her work. It's very abstract, but it's like lots and lots of flowers overlaid on each other. And she sells loads of those. And now I think she's actually going into doing it as a almost as a small business, doing cards and stuff like that.
Well, because you're getting something quite unique. And, you know, I presume most of your club members are Sheffield-based or were Sheffield-based. Or do you get them, you know, so you're buying, it's almost local, isn't it? I mean, I think I bought a print from one of your exhibitions. Not yours, I'm afraid, Gareth. It was somebody else's. But it's at the top of our stairs and it's a belter. But yeah, it's a great, because generally I would say it wasn't that expensive compared to what you can pay for.
Well, you can get, I mean, I've seen similar photographic prints to the ones I've done, you know, going for 3 figures.
Yeah.
I mean, I sell mine for what it costs me plus a tenner.
Yeah, and you get the satisfaction that you're selling your own work.
it's nice. It's quite nice. So that's one option. I mean, there is a club that I know in East Yorkshire. They're called Viewfinder. And what they do is gang together and print a load of, like, birthday cards and that, all taken by groups of photographers. And then they share the money out when they sell, and they sell it to exhibitions and craft fairs and things like that. But they do it as a group. So, you know, if you've got people who are thinking of banding together, because that way you cover lots of different topics.
Yeah, and you're sharing. So it depends, you know, you'd feel a bit sad, wouldn't you, if everybody else was selling all theirs and your pile of whatever was left.
I mean, a percentage of the money goes into the club, so everybody benefits. And then you get your costs covered. So it's a kind of win-win, really, that approach. And then the other way that I make a bit of cash, I mean, it's more pennies than pounds, is through stock photography. So there are the big stock companies like Adobe and Getty Images and Shutterstock, and they will buy photographs from typically professional photographers. But even people like Shutterstock and there are other ones like Smug Mug, you may have heard of, and Zenfolio. Smug Mug are the guys who took over Flickr, and Flickr is quite well known. And what they do is you put your portfolio of images up on their website, and then people might buy that image to use in something else.
I see.
So I've got about 400 images on Smug Mug, I think, and I've sold a few. But the thing is, you only get a few pence each time it sells.
Yeah.
So it's like a licensing deal, really. And it's used for digital. Now, there are some people who put thousands of images up. And, of course, the more good quality images you put up, the more chance you've got of making a bit of cash.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because if you put a particular picture up and it goes global, then you're going to make it's like Spotify, I guess. It's a similar thing. Yeah. You're potentially going to make a bit more out of it.
Yeah, and it depends what it gets used for. You know, if it's picked up by somebody who just likes it and wants it as a bit of background, it gets used once. If it's used by, I don't know, some social media giant, or as you say, it goes viral, you can make quite a bit of money that way.
Wow.
I haven't quite cracked that one.
But isn't it interesting? I wouldn't have known about things like that. But as you say, it's more for people who are really, really into photography to put their images up there.
Yes, I think that's you can't put 5 or 6 pictures up. You've got to have hundreds. You know, you've got to be talking about putting. And the interesting thing about that is, if you go to an exhibition, you might see one of my portraits. On Smug Mug, I might put 20 images from that same session, because they're all slightly different, but they might fit the particular need for whatever is, you know, being used. So it's a way of getting more of my images out there for people to see, if you like.
Yeah, we've noticed in a lot of independent cafes and places, they often have local artists work on the walls.
Yes.
And with a link, you can buy it. Is that yeah. a big thing as well these days?
It's we've tried to do it as a club with a couple of places, and it doesn't generate a lot of, because it's quite a small market.
Yeah.
And it's quite a lot of effort. You're better doing it on, so there are a few people who do it regularly. If you can do it yourself as a one-to-one and get a few prints up and just sell them, that's great. But you are competing against artwork and other sorts of, things.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just photography.
Yeah, ah, brilliant. Paul was saying, what about weddings? Are they not a big thing to make money out of? Or is that a very niche market as well?
It's very competitive.
Mm, yeah. I'm pressured, I would imagine, to get...
Yeah, it's really... I've done two weddings, and I will never do another.
It's a big responsibility, isn't it?
It is, and it's quite hard work. And what I found, I've done two as sort of lead photographer. I've done a few as a sort of second shooter, and I've enjoyed that more because you don't carry all the pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem is trying to get people, particularly now, because everybody's in front of you with their bloody mobile phones, taking pictures when you're trying to get, the group. And then you've got it's usually the bride's mother who insists on directing the shoot, You've gone with a plan. You've come to talk about.
Go on.
With the, I'm being very
politically
incorrect here, but you have a chat with the bride and groom before and you agree a sort of plan, and then you turn up. And other people think they've got better ideas. And that's what frustrated me. It's hard. I mean, it can be, wedding photography now is very lucrative.
Yeah.
Very competitive. You need to be very sure you know what you're doing if you come into that market.
Yeah, but I'm sure if somebody in your family was getting married or had a big event, they'd be asking you, and then the pressure wouldn't be so great, would it, if it's within...
I did... Many years ago, I did do my brother's wedding, and he was fairly happy with it.
Although, so he told you. The trouble is, once it's done, you can't go back and redo it again, can you?
Well, not now, no, because I did his divorce pictures as well.
Oh, my word. Oh, dear. Is it that way you actually blanked out?
We took him out for a drink too when it was all.
Oh,
my other brother and I went, so we took some photos and joked that it was that was his divorce.
As people do now, my parents they got married at Ecclesfield Church in 1965, and my uncle at the time had an 8mm cine camera or something, and he videoed the wedding. We've never seen it. Well, I haven't. I don't even know if it exists. He said, don't bother with photographer. This is all. He had this thing and he did it all. And that was it. Hardly any photos of the wedding or anything. I never saw it. But
unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. I'm sure it wouldn't happen like that these days. But any more ideas, Gareth, before we let you go?
I think the other area to look at is selling your skills. I know we're running a short time. But things like leading workshops, actually teaching people how to, if you're a really good photographer, showing people how to. I run portrait groups and, I charge between 20 and 30 quid a head, most of which goes to the studio and the model.
Yeah, exactly,
But, if I was doing it seriously, I'd probably charge a little bit more. And at the moment, I only do it for club members. But you could, if I opened it out, and I know people have asked me to, I think that's an area you could learn money. Just teaching people how to get off basics.
And you're passing on your skills and getting possibly a younger generation interested as well.
Yeah, that's right. And then it leads into, we do walks around Sheffield. I lead street art walks. I like street art. Don't charge much for it, but... you could make money out of things like that. If you do wildlife tours and you show people how to do wildlife photography, that can really take off because you could start doing foreign tours and all sorts of things.
And with wildlife, the topic's endless, isn't it? You can walk on the river, or and once people get interested, you know, even photographing birds in your garden, once you're interested, you're interested.
Yeah, and all you're doing is giving people basic tips, techniques, helping them to get started. And usually it takes off from there, you know. So.
Brilliant. Well, we'll have to let you go now because the film show is in after us at 12 o'clock. Brilliant chat as always, Gareth. Fantastic.
All right, super.
We'll speak to you next month. Okay,
yeah,
take care.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.